Okay, maybe we can make a start. So welcome everybody. Thanks very much for coming today. I'm really excited to welcome Peter Hitchcock, who's come all the way from New York. Not today, thankfully. So
yes.
Hopefully the jet lag should be. So he's Professor of English at the Graduate Centre and Baruch College of the City University of New York. Also affiliated though with the Department of Comparative Literature, and I don't know if this is going to come up later, there's kind of interesting relationships there between English literature and comparative literature. Also associated then with women's studies and film studies programmes. He's the Associate Director of the Centre for Place, Culture and Politics at the Graduate Centre, and has published and is in the middle of publishing, I think, quite a lot of books and articles. So we've got already Dialogics of the Oppressed, Oscillate Wildly, Imaginary States, The Long Space, edited special journal issues on Bakhtin and on Spinoza. Recent and forthcoming works include How to Read a Discipline for Comparative Literature, Defining the World of Anthology on Literary Materialisms, The Work of Subjects for Cultural Critique, and The Leninist Hypothesis for Poetics Today. He tells me he's got three books in progress, which is quite a lot to be working on at one time, but I think this is testimony to the kind of real kind of richness of the kind of stuff he does. So those are Trading Objects, Worker of the World, and Seriality.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, today he's going to be talking to us about what the title is, Otherworlding, Comparatism in the 21st Century. So I'll let him.
Thank you.
Tell you more.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Mohamed Salah and Katrine. I'll thank you in advance of your response. A very dangerous thing to do, I know, but.
Might be easier than afterwards.
Oh dear, let me get out a different paper. I thought I might start out by saying a few things to situate this contribution. I really see this as a kind of a companion piece to the essay that Jane just mentioned, How to Read a Discipline. That was in comparative literature, and it's part of the process of comparative literature's 10-year cycle of self-identity in the States, where they sort of hand-wring a little bit at the ACLA, but they produce volumes around the question of what should the identity be of comparative literature, and what should its relationship be to other departments in institutions of higher learning in particular. So in that piece, I look at The Rhetoric of Temporality by de Mont, and the sort of informing ideas about symbol and allegory that he develops, not just in that essay, but in the collection Blindness and Insight that came out a few years subsequent to that. And then, rather than just leaving that as sort of a normative reading of the lates and the greats in comparative literature, I put it alongside research that was going on at that time in media studies, specifically the work of Dorfman and Matelaert. A book called How to Read Donald Duck, which is actually a very fascinating work. But of course, you say that title and people say, oh my God, really? But what they're thinking of is the extent to which those of us who are interested in the imagination, works of literature, culture, should take more seriously how mediation works in the production and reproduction of cultural value. And of course, their intervention is a specifically political one about the role of Disney in South America and the sort of images that were being more or less force-fed to young people at that time in the 60s. So that's a rather stark juxtaposition, right? But I wasn't doing that in a gestural manner. I just wanted to provoke some questions about whether or not we should be thinking about mediation and mediation theory in relation to comparative literature today. and I connect it to a concept called remediation, where at least in English departments in the States, remediation is that thing that you don't want to have to do, right? Which is remediation in the narrow sense, remedying the shortfall in language and reading of the student body. But actually, in media theory, remediation also has this much more positive side, which is how to conceive of culture when media and mediation are seen as principal agents in the production and circulation of culture in the current conjuncture. And there's a lot that makes sense in that. But again, in literature departments, we're very hesitant about that. You know, that way, I don't know, social science lies or sociology or those guys in media studies and communication studies. But it's about, to my mind, being dialogic about both sides. You know, so I wouldn't say that the article is necessarily ordering comp litters to just take note of media theory, but media theory itself has to understand how imagination is elaborated within the study of literature, if it really wants to see how cultural messages get circulated. And then clearly, there are clearly critics on the media studies side who are doing this, but it's a fairly narrow conversation at the moment, and I was hoping to expand it. The other side of remediation, actually, is the I was mentioning this to Jane earlier in the walk over here, is this it's a sort of the Spivakian move too, right? Where the remedy is also the poison, right? The idea of the pharmacon, and that people think that the only the cure rejuvenates, but a little bit of poison can rejuvenate as well. And so if media studies is poison to comp lit, then so be it. So this is a companion piece to that particular argument. And the other thing about this piece, it's short, at least for me. there's about half of it is not here, but I can indicate what some of that is in my opening remarks, and maybe the rest can come up in discussion. I'm thinking about cultural correlatives for a work of economic analysis. And so not just Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, which is a subject of this part of the essay, but also Costa Gravis's film, Le Capital, which, you know, coming from cinema studies, it's not a great movie, right? But it actually says some things about capital as an economic relation that are difficult to enunciate in other cultural forms. I'm also thinking in the what you're not getting in the French translation of a Japanese manga version of Das Kapital. So you've got German to Japanese to French. I don't know whether any of you have seen this manga, but it became quite popular after 2008, after the financial crisis of 2007-2008. It was a bestseller in Japan and is now available in 14 languages, I think. So the event, as it were, of capitalist crisis. And then another version of this, Rana Dasgupta's book, Capital, which is about how New Delhi has turned into not only a megacity for capitalism, but is simultaneously a capital in the other sense, right? That it is a lesson for the rest of India, politically, culturally, spatially. So some of this is spatial critique. So you might say, phew, I'm glad we don't have to listen to that part of the paper. So I'll give you the this part, this section of the paper that I thought you might be of interest to you directly, but also, again, sort of provoke some response, provoke some questions that we can discuss afterwards. So, a lot of my own work on intercultural literary practice has occurred under the rubric of transnationalism, by which I mean a materialist methodology that attends to how post-colonialism works culturally, not just through, but across and between formations of the nation-state. Jane mentioned a couple of those books, Imaginary States and The Long Space, but also an essay called The Ethics of World Literature, which I did for one of Damrosch's anthologies. I guess we should call him David Damrosch Inc. now, because so much of world literature is owned by David. The World, and another essay, The World, the Literary and the Political. You know, if you're interested at all, you can just Google that stuff, and it's infinitely free. There is an appreciable desire to work outside these parameters, which has its own revolutionary impress. I mean, outside this idea of moving across and between formations of the nation state. But there is also considerable value in taking seriously the genuflections of decolonizing states, both for tracking genealogies of democratic self-identity and for articulating and critiquing the effulgence of the failed state as a judgment on post-colonialism to the core. I've got a couple of essays on that too, but the main one is called Postcolonial Failure and the Politics of Nation. The Arab Spring and its wake, for instance, is a provocative conjunction in this regard. And Mohamed Salah and I were talking before about what's been going on in the Arab Spring. Here, my focus on elements of method has more to do with the symptomatic and the heuristic in a mode of postcolonial practice that is at home in the world of comparative literature. Although I'm bound to say, and not just because I'm also a literary theorist, that the concerns of comparatism are vital to a critical understanding of the striking historical events in the world putatively beyond it. So, you know, these are what's going on in theorizing comparative lit isn't simply irrelevant to those larger historical events with which we may be more familiar. Indeed, this dialectic is partly at stake in otherworlding. The frisson, moving contradiction, let us say, the processus errende, Widerspruch, that phrase from Grundrisse, of concept of world that otherwise do not seem to fit. My thesis, however, lies more in the subtitle of the paper, Comparatism in the 21st Century. This is a rather obvious rephrasing of the title of Thomas Piketty's publication sensation, Le Capital au XXIe siècle, Capital in the 21st Century. Surely, the comparative literature specialist will aver, you do not mean to imply that our practices are somehow analogous or homologous to the nasty tale of capital that Piketty spins. For shame, sir. Piketty's book is not really about capital as such, although this has not stopped countless commentators from proclaiming that Marx is dead, thankfully, somewhat belatedly, and capital has a new analytic. To be fair, there are plenty of critics of Marx's magnum opus who also say it is not about capital. Frederick Jameson, for instance, has argued Volume 1 is about unemployment. That's in the book Representing Capital. What if comparatism in the 21st century is not really about comparatism, or rather it can be, but is simultaneously or always already inscribed in a logic of relation in which its very possibility is constitutive? That is to say, as soon as one takes Piketty's book in its publication, translation, circulation, reception, and as an analysis of the very economic conditions in which such processes are structured, are we not at once plunged into the difficulties of the world as concept in world literature, or the kinds of worldiness, worlding, and global distinction that have become comparative literature's primary comport? So I am not thinking about analogy or homology, but more perhaps about allegory in de Monts' sense, or Jameson's, or one of Harvey's 17 contradictions. That's number 6 on capital as a process or thing. Or what Emily Apter is against in Against World Literature, with perhaps an addendum on what we are for in global comparatism. Or what Googie means by a globalectical imagination in his book Globalectics. So I do not link these in the service of some grand récit or some supermarket grab bag that proffers cultural capital at the expense of ignorance of incompatibility. Piketty's book has serious flaws, for instance, but it is not guilty of intellectual posturing. Right? It's a very honest book in that sense. I do not offer the full weight of my contrarian passion. All comparatism is dissensus. But desire instead to provide a brief outline of what happens to comparatism when capital is taken not just as an embarrassing relative, which is what I've become, but as the subject, content, and form of its global protocols. So Piketty's text is itself more richly symbolic than allegorical and cleaves intimately to the totality capital suggests. Wrapped in the armor of impressively arrayed statistical analysis, Piketty's critique attempts to show how wealth increases even or especially when income does not. And thus the bad guys, now known rather blandly as the 1%, get richer and richer. The answer to this torrid state, which accidentally coincides with the policy positions of kinder, gentler liberals for capitalism, is progressive taxation and a global wealth tax. Capital is not the problem. It is those winners who buy outrageously long yachts or create philanthropic fiefdoms through which they can, if they wish, eradicate the odd disease or have socially necessary buildings named after them. Tax the rich. There is humour in here, by the way, so don't hold back. Tax the rich is a great slogan, and coming from a public education system that is asphyxiating from an ever-increasing lack of public funds, I cannot dismiss a polemic that might remedy the profession that is gasping around me. I am interested in particular in the way Piketty's narrative, as he calls it, is constructed and augmented in relation to its textual event and eventness. I'm using eventness in the way that Bakhtin does. He's thinking about structures of event, structures of time and place. So eventness links to his notion of the chronotope. There is something in the life of capital, depicted that has a distinctly literary feel, even with its calculations, and this contributes to its allegorical comparatism, as if this is the only way in which its story can be told. At the heart of Piketty's text is an argument about the distribution of wealth and how within capitalism this distribution of the sensible has only been sensible to those for whom the selling of their own labour has been a decidedly marginal factor in their accumulation strategies, i.e. they don't have to work. La richesse itself has a wealth of associations and is perhaps less easy to scale than statistics would suggest. Pointedly, Piketty begins not with the NAO, the National Audit Office, or its French equivalent, the Cour des Comptes, but with Jane Austen and Honoré de Balzac, because literary comparatism can bring life to being in a way that numbers alone cannot. So we're saved, right? One could make a similar point about Badiou's Lettre, L'Evénement, where Mallarmé Zuncudéder works hard to abolish the impenetrability of Zermelo-Frankel set theory. Has anybody read Being an Event?
I tried.
Yeah. It's, you know, I always used to think that my books were a cure for an insomnia, but I think Batty has got it down. Not all of them, though. But it is an extremely, extremely complicated book, and you really have to know your set theory to make any sense of it. This, of course, is a throw of the dice on Piketty's part, because while few would dispute that Austen and Balzac, and I'm quoting from Piketty now, were intimately acquainted with the hierarchy of wealth in their respective societies, what makes them respective to one another necessitates rather more methodological finesse. For instance, when Piketty notes Balzac and Austen understood that land in their societies yielded about 5% on the capital invested, but this was so taken for granted they hardly needed to mention it, or that their readers were well aware, and I'm quoting, it took capital on the order of 1 million francs to produce an annual rent of 50,000 francs, a considerable leap of faith is required. So when Raymond Williams wrote of a sociology of culture, he did not mean that culture could be read simply as sociology, but that culture in his concept was deeply sociological, that society always had complex cultural coordinates in which the terms of imbrication between the two were more than evidentiary, and certainly more than author adjudicated. So to note that, and again I'm quoting, in Great Britain the average income was on the order of £30 a year in the early 1800s when Jane Austen wrote her novels, Piketty implies that all statistical analysis needs is a little literary corroboration to establish a meaningful critique of capital. He continues, the characters in her novels consider themselves free from need only if they dispose of incomes of £500 to £1,000 a year. It's really quite fascinating to pull this stuff out of the argument. I mean, the numbers are great too, but there's something else going on here, and that's what this paper is sort of about. There has already been quite a lot of response to Piketty's intimations of the literary, from the mundane, a number of blogs in the Huffington Post, to the somewhat bizarre. This is a New York Republic headline underneath a web grab from Ong Lee's 1995 film version of Sense and Sensibility. And I quote, Thomas Piketty is wrong. America will never look like a Jane Austen novel, unquote. Interesting. Which overlooks, for instance, an intriguing film adaptation of the same novel in 2011. It's called From Prada to Nada. Has anybody seen that? You can actually stream it. I don't think it ever made it into the theatres, actually. But it's set in Los Angeles. What I find interesting is that the cultural referencing is doggedly nationalist, which is to say that normative transnationalism often proceeds by a taxonomic pivot on the nation idea. So this is why a critical transnationalism must start with the bad new things, with neither a simple rejection nor endorsement of the nation state. So part of what I'm saying here is that the corroboration that he sees in the literary is rigidly nationalist. So Jane Austen will corroborate the English data, and Balzac will corroborate the French. But the contradictions between the two, there he remains silent. Capital may be thoroughly globalized, but any focus on economic difference must first negotiate the mediatory function, as that term again, of an objectified elsewhere, or what we can think of as otherworlding. And I'll suggest an alternative theorization in a little bit. Obviously, what Posner and Weil are objecting to in the New Republic piece is the notion that by virtue of its inequality gap, contemporary America has economic truck with the landed gentry of Britain in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, instead of maintaining its exceptional paragon right in the American dream. Now, I don't have time here to explore further the theoretical coordinates of this pop cultural reconnaissance, but it is indicative of globalization's cultural logic, which will have relevance to my later comments on world literature. Capital, for Piketty, is to be understood via a brief detour, or what he calls un petit détour, through literature, which is in fact a précis on the cultural discourse and difference of wealth in Britain and France. So on the one hand, this reflects the kind of archival depth necessary for Piketty to make his argument. I don't know whether you've read this, but Chris Giles did a long piece in the Financial Times trying to take Piketty down for his misalignment of the English archive, the archive that that Piketty used. I mean, all of this is up on the web, the background information that Piketty used in his critique. It's still subject to dispute, however. I mean, you don't have to agree with Giles. I think there are other ways you can disagree with the data as it's been interpreted, or the methodology used to gather the data. On the other hand, there is a knock-on effect from using these statistical sources, since they enhance the possibility of an Anglophone readership beyond the French. Again, we might say it is perfectly natural for English readers to identify and or dispute the Austen angle on wealth. My point is that generally such an interpretation not only follows linguistic competence, but also a cultural fragmentation within global difference, so effectively suspending the intercultural for the relative stability of autonomy. So transnationalism for publishing this work in another language, but cultural autonomy when we want to interpret the data with a particular literary correlative. It is this sens du monde, and perhaps a sense that Nancy does not countenance, but I'll use the phrase anyway, that overdetermines the structure of capital in the analytic and is the scene of its most profound antinomy. Generally, while Piketty's literary references are anodyne, they can also reach the level of provocation, and I quote, In the classic novels of the 19th century, wealth is everywhere. And no matter how large or small the capital or who owns it, it generally takes one of two forms, land or government bonds, unquote. I think everybody has a list of exceptions to this statement. Yet what if we limited it by suggesting that the novel does many things, but this is its classic form in the 19th century? So kind of read it from the opposite end, the way Piketty is interpreting it, but make it the classic form for specific reasons. Rather than an idle thought experiment, it reminds us of a long-standing impasse in analysing capital, that it is not representable in itself, right, it's a relation, and is therefore bound to representational surrogates, whose forms are both quantifiable and qualitatively distinct. I've recently argued in an essay titled Defining the World for that book, Literary Materialisms, that Jane mentioned, that Marxism has wrestled mightily with representability in capital, and that this has precipitated some novel reading protocols. As you can imagine, in my work, that's a double entendre. I give three examples of reading capital from Althusser, Harvey, and Jameson, based on respectively the symptomatic, the logical, and the figural. They are simultaneously reading Marx's Capital while reading Marx reading and reading Marxism itself. The comparatism at stake not only concerns those literary critiques that draw extensively on these methods. So for instance, Pierre Macherey's theory of literary production, right, it's basically an Althusserian model of reading within, across, and between languages, but also takes seriously the fact that the concept of world is radically under-theorized in world literature. Okay. In the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels take it on faith that the worlding of capital has an objective correlative in Goethe's Weltliteratur. So I'm drawing a parallel between what Piketty is doing in his book on capital and what Marx and Engels do in the Manifesto. So mostly Marx, but we still credit Engels somehow. Marx and Engels take it on faith that the worlding of capital has an objective correlative in Goethe's Weltliteratur. I would argue it is this answer to capital's unrepresentability that drives Piketty's assessment of the classic 19th century novel. The irony, of course, is that while Marx and Piketty are both readers of Balzac regarding capitalist exploitation, Piketty now claims he has not read Marx's Capital, a position that David Harvey argues on his website is eminently clear from reading Piketty's book. In more generous fashion, I would say Piketty is a creative misreading, sort of Capital as catachresis. I think he's actually fibbing, but he's been accused so much of being, you know, sort of a raging commie and socialist that he said, well, I can't be one of those because I've not even read Das Kapital. But if you look at the notes to his book, Capital is all over the place. Still, perhaps it doesn't matter, especially for those of us who have worked in literary comparatism. And yet the space between Marx and Piketty is like that between Austin and Balzac. It describes a conceptual bar on how the world is differentiated. Let us say, it concretizes wealth in land and bonds only by abstracting the world for translation and exchange. What Piketty's book makes clear, both in its translation and circulation in its source language, which is a kind of Damrosian world literature, right, commensurate with the force of commodification. I mean, that's from Damrosch's definition, right, of world lit, is that wealth not only needs to be redistributed, but also redefined. Something that Marx once attempted in his use of the word Gemeingut, which in itself marks a contrast with Piketty's opening epigraph from The Rights of Man of 1789 about l'utilité commune. I think that's, again, you know, those phrases are not the same, right? The difference between commonwealth and common utility. We know that a text of economy, even one with a missing text on political economy, i.e. it refuses to concede that capital is not capital when it doesn't move, does not become literature merely by using the literary as a cultural symbolic. Fine. We also understand that even though the overwhelming business of translation is business translation, i.e. that which facilitates economic exchange, I think it's over 80%, We rightfully resist the reduction of the global literary to being an adjunct of globalization as such. Where I teach, would that we resist more strenuously the exploitation of the adjunct in our professional status, a dialectic of precarity that I won't pursue here. Now, this is not my point in thinking the interpretive dynamics brought to bear in the problem of capitalist relation as book and as cultural phenomenon. Piketty's rationale for using Austen and Balzac is simple enough. Their emergence is coterminous with the data set and allows us to pause on the meaning of the latter. He appreciates their modes of telling, an art that in Balzac is exhaustive, if not exhausting. Over 90 novels, right? I have already noted a coded difference in these texts, which extends not just between the country and the city as settings, but also through how responses are filtered by concerns over cultural resonance. Piketty wants to reference the longue durée of Capital, but at this level, the New Republic is actually right. I don't think this may be the first time I've agreed with the New Republic in public. The anachronism of Austen should also be taken seriously. If indeed Capital is the engine that gives world literature material substance, it is equally the case that literature has moved in this lived relation. The grounds of comparatism have shifted. So Punctea's essay, Grounds of Comparison, artfully tracks the problematic edges of Benedict Anderson's imbrication of novel and nation, something I've taken up in my work on Primordia's Bumi Manusia in the long space. Capital in the 21st century rests on this relation without articulating its complex dissimulation to the present. So, in other words, Piketty's invocation of the literary might have unpacked such movement in our understanding of wealth under capitalism, but tends instead to offer the novel as a diorama, right? So this is the sort of the fixed condition of the novel. And even though it might be late 18th, early 19th, this can be used to corroborate the data in the 21st century. It's an interesting move, right? And I'm not sticking all of this actually on Piketty, because I would actually argue that there are significant figures, let's say, within literary study who do exactly the same thing, right? For better or worse. This is not the result of, say, Balzac's dogged realism or Austen's rigid social distinctions, whose limits nevertheless represent radical possibility. I realise now you could read that as rigged, because sometimes they are rigged in Austen's work. But because Piketty does not want to read any more of the novels as fiction than would allow wealth to appear today. So, Piketty notes that Sir Thomas in Mansfield Park has some difficulty managing plantations several thousand miles away in the West Indies. Then he comments, this is Piketty again, tending to one's wealth was not a tranquil matter of collecting rent on land or interest on government debt, unquote. Now, for those of us who have spent some time fathoming colonial subjugation and resistance, this comes as something of an understatement. At the level of allegory, what happens to comparatism in the 21st century if the politics and poetics of post-coloniality are represented otherwise in the onward march of wealth? That they get submerged in these comparisons. How can world literature disrupt this tiny narrative of stable forms, the novel, amidst globalizing economic relations, the frenetic capital? I don't have space here to elaborate more fully the productive tension of capital and comparatism that yet gives me pause about the world in world literature as a constitutive antinomy. That's in sort of the longer version. But let me offer some salient points, or maybe not so salient, that indicate at least some of the argument's parameters, however fanciful or impossible these connections might be. So I'm getting towards the end now. Piketty's Capital emerges from a sincere and protracted concern to understand the objective conditions of the wealth gap in contemporary capitalism. Now, on one level, this is an anxiety of affluence, in which the economic hierarchies of long-standing states have now assumed the force of a global dominant. On a deeper level, however, the explanatory power of the data obfuscates the logic of capital in the world by assuming the concepts in both can be honed by policy adjustments, that they just need a little bit of policy and things will get better. It's comparatism. It's not simply subject to institutional fiat. How does its worldliness undo or challenge the platitudes of global integration the wealth index offers? So what can comparative literature's methodologies do to kind of upset this assumption that it's just a matter of policy? Piketty's book is not a work of literature, as you might have guessed. But I would like to think that, like Hegel's Phenomenology, it could be read as a novel, a quadruple-decker, perhaps, or a much-truncated comedy humaine. More pertinently, people have tried to write the Phenomenology as a novel, but they haven't tried to read Piketty as a novel yet, but you heard it here first. More pertinently, the literary references in the tome provide a kind of resoluteness that raw data ironically cheat. And I'm thinking here of Moretti's Grass, Maps, and Trees, right, as a correlative. In his idea of distant reading, right, you can easily misread that to think that you're not supposed to read. Right? I mean, my undergraduates love the Moretti piece where he says that. Great, so those 12 novels you assign Hitchcock are just, maybe I can do the tweet instead. But that's not really what it's about. I mean, what he's trying to do is get to think about pattern recognition, to interrogate those other reading methods, right? To sort of put them into collision with one another. So it strikes me, however, that the pitfalls of distant reading, which could be that misreading, might also illuminate the limits of distant data, right? The assumption that the numbers will make the argument for you. The notion of Balzac as far away, so close, is both a representational gloss and a gloss on representationality. If the world needs diagrams, like the ones that Piketty provides, or indeed Moretti, it also requires a diagrammatology, right? So that would be my sort of deconstructive urge to think about these diagrams in the form of différence, how they displace at the same time that they argue for a specific truth. Because most of us take it on faith, right? That if it's graphed, it is true. Again, this is a contradictory space of negotiation, or rather, it is the scene of contradiction about space in the world for both capital and literature. Basically, Piketty uses literature to jump scales as he arrays the world, but this is not an unproblematic methodological move. Nirvana Tanuki's work on scale in world literature accentuates the importance of the concept, while often sidestepping the fraught politics of this dynamic. In post-colonialism, the loss of third in third world literature should not signal a departure from its insurgent claims, but a lesson about the scales of development in relation, to south-to-south discussions or regional inflections like Caribbeanness or Antillonite. Piketty's book underlines the fulcrum of untranslatability in Capital within and between languages. Marxism, for instance, as Karl Korsch maintained, has two languages about accumulation and class struggle, and labours to transcode the two in the face of the untranslatable. What to do? While it would not be fair to insert capital as a philosophical term into the wonderful complexity of Cassin's et al.'s Dictionary of Untranslatables, capital does not appear, obviously, in that book, its troubling genre as a moving contradiction moves uneasily in its philosophical disposition, like the word European, right, that was dropped for the dictionary's English title. Indeed, Capital, like Untranslatables, is a dialectical challenge to world literature, offering as it does not the ears of world, but a kind of ontic displacement at the level of data and description. I think Piketty's use of the words value and convergence also function as wayward lexical levers. In other words, I'd like to do a kind of Cassin-esque reading of those terms as untranslatables in Piketty's work. Homework even for me. Counterintuitively, the project of untranslatables, especially in the work of Emily Apter, gives us a world literature in what cannot be translated, but must be, in a sense, to suture worldliness. from Walter Benjamin, we might say this is the impossible task of the translator. I agree with Googie that postcolonial literature is closest to a positive image of world literature, but I also concur with his sense that it is deeply contaminated politically, theoretically, and historically. Saying that it is its own moving contradiction provides little solace, yet it has to be said that postcolonialism at once draws attention to the most impressive elision in Piketty's invocations, literary or otherwise, the world beyond an Anglophone, Francophone conversation. It is true, sub-Saharan Africa appears in his book as the world's poorest region, and that Piketty provides extensive details on the tribulations of the developing world. I mean, it's not like it's absent completely as data. But where is the literature, right? Where's the need for correlative metrics that Piketty finds so easily available in the wealth of the archives of London and Paris? It's almost as if post-colonial writing does not exist, right? I mean, you could have your own, you can come up with your own titles here. I was thinking about G. Thales' Narcopolis, or Abani's Graceland, anything by Amdar or Davy, even Adichie, although it'd have to be a finer argument with Americana, I think, their most recent book. But none of that is there, right? So we've got these correlatives earlier on in this narrative, as he calls it, but completely absent when it comes to mapping the rest of the world in terms of this data. Under colonialism, the colonized often did not count, literally and figuratively. In the 21st century, the post-colonial has no capital account, right? It has no account in this story of capital. And this will take more than tinkering with world literature anthologies. Sorry, David. I mean, Damish. Which leads me to a final point. Capital in the 21st century underlines both the perspicacity and the limits of Casanova's world systems approach to world literature. On the one hand, Piketty's book as event is a lesson in the logic of the global publishing industry. That the English version falls to Harvard and Belknap reminds one of the buzz they generated for Hart and Negri's Empire. So again, I would use sort of a theory of the event to understand that. Not to occlude the arguments that are going on within the text, but actually to enhance the meaning to some extent. On the other hand, Casanova's assessment of the periphery and the peripheral reproduces a systemic marginality, and the world otherwise slips through the knot of Wallerstein's abrupt notion of geoculture, right? She uses a Wallersteinian world systems theory. You know, geoculture is Wallerstein's version of that, but that is emerges out of a kind of a Weberian impulse, not necessarily the ones that otherwise inform Casanova's work. Comparatism has always been much more than this, we say, but if it wishes to assume the burdens of the world, in its term world literature, it must also be prepared to fathom the peculiarities of its redistributive wealth, because these things are connected. Such a profile may indeed rest beyond its institutional largesse and sometimes even literary protocols. Let me emphasize this otherworlding in the positive sense, not simply as exegesis and translation on behalf of another, but as a process in which the agency of the world is the prerogative of another. Within that logic, comparatism still has a world to win. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Peter, for an incredibly rich and stimulating presentation that I'm sure is going to generate a lot of questions and a lot of
thrown objects.
And, but perhaps I can call catching up just maybe a kind of formal response before we go.
I will move to the periphery.
I could go here, another
different periphery. I didn't plan a speech to introduce you, but perhaps I thought you were probably well known to everybody here. Professor of German at Jesus College and Catholic German.
Right, well, this is a very, very difficult task. Thank you for a lovely paper, a very stimulating paper, which I had read before, and thought I probably needed perhaps 3 years research leave to really work through it.
Oh dear.
I bought the book, a very substantial book. I had a look at it, and contended with the question of capital and how it relates to literature, and found that very stimulating, so thank you very much for that. Perhaps to start with the final points, I'm only really going to pick out very selectively a few issues that struck me where I felt I had perhaps something to say and think about that other people might also be interested in thinking about. To start then with the final issue of the periphery and the centre, mm-hmm. which is very striking about Piketty's approach. And I was, however, also struck by the point that post-colonial literature is closest to a positive image of world literature, but that is also deeply contaminated politically, theoretically, and historically. The question then for me is, to what extent should comparative literature straight away take on the burdens of the world? Mm-hmm. To what extent does that actually narrow its remit and the kind of questions that are asked, mm-hmm. and tend towards creating binary oppositions that mm-hmm. are often problematic? Mm-hmm. The question of, I mean, for instance, two worlds comes up in Piketty's book in interesting ways, but yes. of course very reductively. Mm-hmm. But are we in fact in danger of creating that same reductive world, which mm-hmm. consists either of one monolithic construct or of the marked and the unmarked, or other, or however we might want to construct it? So that's a difficulty I have generally with comparative literature, because it seems to me that in the project of moving beyond the national literature, which is predicated on diversity, because when we talk about one national literature, we are tending also to think of lots of other national literatures, perhaps only one or two, but usually not just the one. Mm-hmm. Whereas with world literature, there is this tendency to think that perhaps actually we can encompass it all, and in some way we are. I mean, for instance, the introduction of Damrosch's mm-hmm. Book seems to me an exercise in that we sort of pick and choose and actually have this idea that we can encompass it in some way through an anthology, whatever. And engaging with the burdens of the world, then, a problem, and the monolithic narrative seems to me a considerable danger, because it reduces literary diversity, and that might also be literary diversity or diversity of literary projects, to a single homogenous discourse or a single binary opposition. Also, the status that in putting comparative literature together with this iconic capital, does one then end up with a few icons that keep being bandied about, mm-hmm. And through which one then argues the case, but actually that masks all sorts of more complex discourses that might be going on in the periphery. Mm-hmm. The whole discourse that we're having now is in English, therefore to what extent can we critique that monolithic focus on one culture, one world, which in fact comparative literature has actually promoted, and the whole concept of globalization has promoted the obliteration of other languages in the one global language, mm-hmm. English. One question that then also arises, if it's assumed that world literature disrupts a tidy narrative of stable forms amidst globalising economic relations, mm-hmm. Are we in danger then of creating a different kind of tidy narrative of stable forms, mm-hmm. and stabilising everything into this one monolithic structure? So I think whichever way one comes at it, there is this difficulty of the monolithic or the binary opposition, each of which is a way of stabilising complexity. Mm-hmm. And One thing that has struck me often with the status that Goethe's concept of Weltliteratur has taken on over the last few decades, it didn't used to be as prominent as it is now. It's now taken on iconic status and has been taken out of its discursive context, where really Goethe is to some extent arguing for a kind of Weltliteratur because national literature is problematic in the German context, was even in the 18th century, has become increasingly so. So that the extent to which one wants to leave one's national problems behind and the guilt of one's own nation, be it Nazi Germany, be it colonial past and so on, becomes then a way of giving the project a kind of unquestioned status that is predicated on some sort of assumption that what one is doing is morally better than what other people are doing, who are dealing with smaller questions that might or might not be linguistically specific and or culturally specific. I wanted to finish with a question that arose in my mind of the kind of very different question that one might ask, and where I think Piketty's book raises some interesting issues. Now, you said if capital is the engine that gives world literature material substance and so on, you then carried on. Now, one, as it were, group of works, one particular historical context which throws up some quite interesting issues in that context, I think, is GDR literature, where, in fact, capital wasn't really the engine. And where in place of the kind of capitalist structures that drive book production in the Western world, in a very specific Western world, you had political forces deciding on what was and was not published, decided where the paper was made available, what bookshops would sell, and so on. Now, the shift from the GDR to the West German context, was that a good thing or a bad thing for East German writers? It's quite a complex picture. So we have very different models there of what is driving literature. And it suggests that assuming that capitalism is the one driving engine obliterates those kind of questions that might also throw up some very different structures in other contexts. Now, I don't know what those might be, and the GDR is now, perhaps sadly, no longer with us in getting us to ask those kind of questions. But even questions, for instance, like censorship, what seems in a world where, in the Western world, like censorship, because it's political and therefore has no place in supposedly autonomous literature, in the GDR context looked more like literature as a communal project. So even key concepts that we use in order to judge literature shift. Shift quite subtly, shift in quite unexpected ways and in quite open-ended ways. So for me then the question would be, once we start looking at perhaps African literatures, which would be very diverse, South American, Chinese literature in this very shifting context, what kind of questions might that throw up? And should we perhaps not assume that there is such a thing as world literature? Good.
I did not feel the urge to go and buy the book. So I did not read the cat book. But I actually incidentally listened to a very interesting review on BBC that really takes these points out of different statistics used may be applicable to France, and therefore how the trajectory of the whole argument may be Franco-centric, if you like. So
okay.
even that political economy review of it was echoing the kinds of things you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, like Kate, and I find this paper obviously needs a lot of thinking to unpack, and I'm sure it's elements of it are unpacked in your other essays and work. So it left me really intrigued and leaves me wanting for more, and so I'll probably be asking more questions than I actually have.
Sure.
But I come obviously to this interested in at least in two aspects of it. One of them is the wording, and the other one is obviously, because of my own working background, is the post-colonial and colonial dimensions of comparative literature. So in a sense, these two, if you like, I would have liked, or would like to see, more of the world perhaps the question and answer. So in a word, I would like to have seen more of the capital, if you like, and its intervention. But in a sense, because it is something that gets glossed over in some formulations of world literature, I think it needs all the more. And I think, although I don't understand very well the systems theories and so on, from what I've read of Jameson's argument or reading of Casanova, for example, what we would have is there is a more dispersal, if you like, that loses perhaps the core, which is the market and the global market of capital. So I take examples from, and this is directly quotes from the paper which you kindly provided us with. So if indeed capital is the engine that gives world literature material substance, it is equally the case that literature has moved in this lived relation. The grounds of comparison have moved. I would like for you to tell us more about this. Another example is about comparison and its responsibility or ethical drive. If I use my own word from a recent paper I've done, this is talking about the ethics and the poetics of comparative literature, world literature in particular. This idea, obviously, I think you've taken an essay that I haven't read in Limburg. But that ethics, and I quote you again, if it wishes to assume the burdens of the world, which Caitlin just mentioned, it must also be prepared to fathom the peculiarities of its distributive wealth. This again needs unpacking. But from my perspective, I have been interested in the idea of unequal exchange. I'm here referring to, for example, in political economy, to the idea of unequal development developed by Samir Amin and others, and that led to unequal exchange.
Mm-hmm.
That if that's at the political economic level, then obviously it's elsewhere as well in the cultural field. So in literature, patterns of marketing, for example, of translation, and translations as an example, are important here. In what direction do we translate? What gets translated? Why? The economics of this, not to mention its politics. I'll give you one example from an area I know a little bit more about. For example, the Arabic Booker Prize, there is such a thing, is a prize given to novels every year written in Arabic and that are immediately translated. Now, the economics of this is absolutely fascinating, because the Arabic Booker Prize, as you can know, is named after the Booker Prize. It gets translated into English, but not other languages. It's a massive, if we can speak about any investment in this type of culture as massive, financial incentives for writers.
Mm-hmm.
So it has changed literally the way Arab writers actually write, because and the impetus by which you actually write, because every year there's this massive prize of $50,000 or $100,000 and so on. And then the translation and the Bloomsbury publication and so on. And where does the money come from? The Gulf, Dubai money.
Mm.
So we have this quite incredible capital moving that is affecting literature as we speak. One final point is this conception of world literature as example of either an equal exchange or as an argument for equal exchange,
mm-hmm.
if you like.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it as a capital or as a resistance to capital in that sense, which side is it on, if you like. I mean, I'll just stop there, I think.
Okay, great.
I think what we're going to do is have a bit of a pause now and have a drink, and then give Peter a minute to think through those questions, and then maybe you'd like to kind of come back on them, and of course we'll open it up to the floor. So do please hang around as we drink to entice you to stay.